Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio, hosted by serial entrepreneur Denise Griffiths. Denise offers a full menu of on-the-web services for all your online needs. Denise and her team of virtual assistants can help manage your online business, including social media channels, blogs, web portals, and more. YourOfficeOnTheWeb.com is a comprehensive resource to help you combine the power of your brand, your connections, and innovative ideas to develop a full online strategy that can guarantee a strong profitable impact on your business.
Good morning and welcome to Your Partner in Success Radio. I'm your host, Denise Griffiths, and my mission each week is to bring you the most interesting entrepreneurs, business people, authors, speakers, honestly, just anybody that I can find who are really excited to freely share their business wisdom, their tips, and their actionable advice with us each week. And oftentimes, they will all show up, I'm not even drinking coffee yet, I'm fixing to. They will also share their stories, how they got from where they were to where they are, and where they think they're going, and those stories can be absolutely wonderful to hear. Today, I'm welcoming to the show a fascinating lady. Dr. Patricia Thompson is an award-winning psychologist and management consultant who is passionate about helping her clients flourish. Since 2004, she has advised CEOs and senior leaders to assist them in achieving their best outcomes. She founded Silver Lining Psychology to teach businesses how to use the science of positive psychology to achieve those greater outcomes. She is also the author of The Consummate Leader, A Holistic Guide to Inspiring Growth in Others and in Yourself. She has been featured in CNN.com, Fast Company, Entrepreneur, The Network Journal, MindBodyGreen, iVillage, Elephant Journal, Career Builder, and other sites. Patricia, what in the world are you doing here? Originally from Alberta, Canada, she completed her BA in sociology, at the University of Toronto, and then went on to earn her MA and then PhD in clinical psychology from Georgia State University. As part of her training, she completed a predoctoral internship at the University of Pennsylvania and a postdoctoral fellowship through Emory University School of Medicine. She has taught courses and facilitated seminars at the Wharton Business School, the University of Toronto, Emory University, Spelman College, Georgia State University, and various other organizations. She's also won awards from the American Psychological Association, the Southeastern Psychological Association, and the Georgia Psychological Association for Excellence in Research. So do you understand why I say fascinating? Patricia, welcome to the show. I'm so excited to talk with you again.
Oh, well, thank you so much for having me. I'm really excited to be here, too.
Well, when we did our pre-interview show, I mean, we probably should have recorded that. That was so good.
I know. I can't remember what we talked about, but I remember I was excited about it.
A bunch. We covered a lot of area. Listen, before we get started, would you like to share a bit about yourself that I didn't kind of hit on and your entrepreneurial journey to date?
Sure. So, I mean, I feel like you've covered a lot in terms of my professional life, but I guess in terms of my development as an entrepreneur, I would say that it was largely sparked most recently by the birth of my son. And I have a 14-month-old, really energetic and rambunctious son named Blake. And, you know, for a while, I'd been doing corporate psychology, like I said, since 2004, but I'd been doing it in a more traditional way that was focused primarily, I think, on helping businesses to achieve better results by focusing on people. And while it's the sort of work that I do today, I've just kind of put a bit of a different spin on it. You know, all along in my background, you know, I have this background in clinical psychology and thinking in a very humanistic way about people and really wanting to find the nugget of goodness in them or thinking in a positive way about how to help them to live more fulfilling lives. And I felt that the work that I was doing up to that point, while it would touch on that, that wasn't really the central aspect of that work. And, you know, when I had my son, I guess I just realized, you know what, life is short. I'm telling him, you know, as I'm feeding him in the middle of the night that, you know, I want him to go after his dreams and to love his life and to be really fulfilled. And I felt like maybe I wasn't fully living up to what I was telling him to do. And so I decided that for myself, I really wanted to take a different spin in my work and really do things that I felt were going to be more fulfilling to me, which was really focused on the positive psychology aspect of things. And so that's when I really got silver lining psychology off the ground and decided to go into that full steam ahead to really help people to, you know, have better business outcomes, but by bringing joy to work and focusing on how things like happiness and kindness and mindfulness and all of these sorts of buzzwords that you hear today can really have an impact in the work world. And so I guess it's been sort of a more recent development in my entrepreneurial journey, but one that's been really fulfilling.
And, you know, Patricia, you wouldn't think that these are words that you have to be reminded of, but you do. It's the oddest thing.
Yeah, I mean, you really wouldn't think that, but what I found is that, especially in the business world, often people can be a little bit skeptical of words like that. And I think, you know, in business, you're so used to hearing about, you know, ROI or what are the metrics that we're using or goals. And so words like compassion and being present and, you know, thinking of empathy can seem very much at odds to a lot of people who've had a really traditional business upbringing. But the research tells us and shows us that all of that stuff is really important because, you know, even if we're at work, we're still whole people who have these needs. And so once I can show the research and the numbers that kind of back it up, then I usually have more of a willing audience.
How did that, do you happen, I know you've done a lot of research. You're a masterful researcher. Do you have any kind of an idea or even a brief explanation of how the perceived American culture, corporate culture came along? I mean, the corporate culture right now is perceived as hard, unyielding. You know, just the American populace looks at corporations, even though they fund so much of what we do in life, as almost alien entities. They're not nice, they're not kind, but that's actually not true. But how did that perception come along? Do you happen to know?
Yeah, you know, in terms of the history of that, I don't know that I can really speak to that intelligently. I know that historically, you know, there was a theory of management that looked at people less as whole people, I guess, and more in terms of thinking of them in terms of, you know, like how much productivity you can get out of each person.
Right.
And
well,
so
that makes sense.
And so it wasn't a really well-rounded approach. And I think, you know, if you just think about business and what you hear in the media, often it's the really egregious things that get the biggest headlines. And so, you know, it's when there's been some sort of white-collar crime that's gone on, or when you hear about a CEO that has what seems like a really outlandish salary compared to, you know, the average person that works there. And I think that because a lot of people don't have, you know, an entree into the corporate world and they don't get to actually meet the people who work there, they can have a pretty stereotyped view of what business is like. And
right.
I'll say that before I started working in business, I had a similar point of view, so I can totally understand it.
Yeah, you do have to kind of pull back the curtain and peer behind it, don't you, to see what's going on or at least get a glimpse.
Yeah, I mean, you know, in working with CEOs, what I realized that I don't think I fully appreciated before, which is kind of embarrassing to admit, but CEOs are real people. They have families. They have insecurities. They have a lot of pressure on them. And, you know, they have vulnerabilities. And, you know, they're actual real people. And while, you know, some of them might take advantage of the power that they have and make choices that, you know, a lot of us would question, most of them are just people who want to do a good job, want to do a good job for the people who work for them. And, you know, there's a range of personalities, just like there is in any job. But I think, you know, again, what we hear in the media is just the stuff that is so egregious that it can really skew our view of things. Yeah,
exactly. And I love what you're saying, that they're people too. I mean, I get that. I work for myself. I own my own business. And I keep telling myself, I'm a people too. You know, people seem to think I can do magic, and many days I can, but some days I'm like, just back off. I'm just a people. Back off.
Yeah. Yeah. No, like earlier this week I was meeting with the CEO, and he was saying, you know, this is really hard. You know, it's like this person is quitting, potentially, that I don't want to quit. I have this big, visible project that's not going as we had hoped, and everybody's looking at me to fix it. And, you know, I think the face that they have to put out to the organization is that, hey, I always have it going on, and, you know, we'll get through it. But they're a real person behind the curtain as well, so it's true.
Exactly, and I think people would do well to remember that. It's very easy to look at anybody, whether it's somebody in the grocery store or it's somebody on TV or listening to us, and kind of clothe them with your own idea of what their true persona is, and it's just not right. I mean, we're seeing through our own perceptions, aren't we?
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's one of the things that I really love about my job as a psychologist is that I get to hear different people's stories. And, you know, what I know is that what you might see is very often not what it really is behind the scenes. And a lot of people, you know, might appear to be stronger or to have it all together more than they really do. but that's such, I think, a gratifying part of my job that I get to help people and bring them along in that way.
Now, I have to ask you this. How did you, I mean, corporate psychology, I don't even know if that's a very common thing. I mean, I work with a lot of psychologists. I have psychologists as clients, as I, you know, shared with you during our pre-interview. But this is a new one on me, a corporate psychologist, and I'm fascinated by the idea.
Yeah, so I actually fell into it, but I guess, first of all, just to tell you what it is, because a lot of people wonder, corporate psychology is essentially a field in which we work with people within organizations and organizations themselves to help them to, I guess, be more productive by working on people issues. And so there are a number of different things that I do to help with that. So, like, one thing that I do a lot of are called psychological assessments. And basically, you know, if you have someone in a high-level position who you're thinking of hiring for an organization, we can do personality testing on them to ensure that they'll be a good fit for that organization. Because, you know, in one organization, you could have one sort of culture. In another organization, you could have a completely different culture. And depending on that person's personality, they could be really successful in one organization, and they could be a hot mess in another organization. And so really helping to find fit is something that we do a lot of. You know, also do a lot of team building, so helping teams to work more effectively together. Executive coaching is something that I do a lot of as well, so helping people to be effective in their jobs and also helping them to be more effective in coaching the people who report to them. But basically, it's just sort of all things people as it relates to organizations.
Right. And that leads me to my next question, because we are talking about, you know, corporate entities, the people who are in these corporations as people. So I'm guessing, I'm just kind of extrapolating out of what you just said, that when you're working one-on-one or even with groups of these people, that a lot of the takeaway that they learn as far as team building and working within units, they can probably also address that at home, yes? I mean, it's kind of the same thing, isn't it?
Yeah, it's funny how much overlap there is.
That's what I would
say. What's also been really interesting to me is that so many people tend to view their personal and their professional lives as very different, but they're so intertwined. And so, you know, for example, I'll do a personality assessment of someone, and then when I'm sitting down with them to give them some feedback about it, they'll say something like, oh, wow, like, don't tell my wife that. She's been telling me that for years, or, you know, that sort of thing. And so, you know, they might have thought they were being a different person at work, but no, they're really not. And, you know, the sorts of things that I teach them can actually help them to, you know, for example, be a better listener at home or to be more effective in giving their children, you know, reinforcement for things. So that's another really rewarding part of the job for me, too.
Yeah, I like that there's overlap. I think it makes perfect sense. And what I don't get, and I have never understood, is how people can think that they get out of their car, they step into their office, and they've shed their home persona, and they're putting on a suit of a new personality. And I've seen people do it, and I think that is it's almost, I keep waiting for them to become a serial killer. It's just not right, as I'm concerned. It's not right, I'm telling you.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think the one thing is it's hard to do successfully for a long period of time. And so I think that eventually people who do that tend to have blind spots in that, you know, certain aspects are coming through that maybe they're not aware are coming through when they're in interacting with people. And I think the other thing about it is if that's how you're approaching it, it's very constraining. And I think after a while, it can feel almost suffocating if you're feeling like you have to be something that you're not to be effective in your work.
Right, right. So yeah. Let's go back to, and I agree with you. Look, I have seen this, and this is one of the reasons I work alone. I don't have to cope with other people's deals. Plus, I'm an introvert, so what I do is perfect for me. But here's the thing. And we're seeing more and more of this, you know, just be kind to yourself, be kind to each other, you know, smile at people, strike up a conversation, offer assistance, you know, just do the human things that we're supposed to do. How are clients responding to that idea that, you know, just doing positive things every day can help both themselves and the people around them? Are they open to it? Are they looking at you like, that's strange? I mean, what is kind of... How do they respond? I'm dying to know.
It varies. So there are some people for whom I'm preaching to the choir who, you know, really think that the work world should be a positive place and that, you know, if you're coming to work, you should be having fun and it should be upbeat and we should be working well as a team because that makes it more fun. And if you're spending so much time of your life at work, you should be trying to make it as positive as possible. And so there are the preaching to the choir people that, you know, I really love working with because I don't have to sort of convince them that the sorts of things that I'm suggesting are worthwhile. But on the other hand, there are a lot of people who, like I said, can be very skeptical of it. And I think that part of it is that in business school, a lot of what you're taught is sort of being able to measure things. And while I can tell you about the research that's shown that, you know, people who are more positive tend to be better at sales, or CEOs who are more positive tend to have companies that have higher ROIs, you know, those are it's hard to kind of bring that into your organization and measure it in that same way. And so they can be very skeptical of it. And I think also a lot of people who are in organizations can be very type A and achievement driven. And so they're very focused on checking items off their to-do list. And, you know, if I finish this particular project, I can check it off my to-do list. Or if I accomplish this goal, then I know I've accomplished it. And some of the stuff that I'm talking about is less tangible. And so for them, wanting to spend time on it, it's just not something that they want to spend time on. They would rather spend time on something that, you know, they can measure, check off, and know that they've done it. And so they might see it as a luxury that they just don't have time to do, whereas I see it and know that it's a competitive advantage that you have to focus on to really be most effective.
Listen, it took me the longest kind of time to learn that. I'm a type A-driven personality. I have lists that are color-coded. They're gorgeous. You ought to see them. They're beautiful. And I have had to learn to walk away from my list to some degree. I will never not have a list. It's just, I'm quivering just thinking about it. You know, I will always have a list of some sort, but I'm not as driven by my list now. I love that I can check something off. My big thing, honestly, is I had to train myself to stop and really enjoy. And this is odd, but I had to train myself to say, okay, you checked it off. Now, and I have this thing about putting things on index cards because I can check it off and then I can shred it, which is very satisfying to me for some reason. And
yeah,
that's my
little
victory
like
dance. Yeah.
Right.
I learned to take the time to go, woohoo, and I do my little victory. I shred it. I have a good time. I dance with a cat. It took me the longest kind of time to figure out that I needed to really celebrate that. I know I sound nuts, don't I? But I work alone. I can do this.
That doesn't sound nuts to me.
It makes sense.
Yeah. And it's funny because
it makes
me think of... Oh, go ahead.
Oh, no, I'm done.
Oh, I was going to say it's funny because, you know, you should see the look sometimes on some of the faces of people I work with when I talk to them about something like meditation, mm-hmm. Or something like that, where they're kind of looking at me quizzically like, you just want me to sit here and do nothing? Like, why are you suggesting that I do this? You know, and, you know, it's because you need to be a better leader and you need to learn right. to be more present with people and not always have your brain going ahead. But, yeah, I mean, for people who are really driven, just sitting still can seem very threatening and non-productive.
It is tough.
Yeah.
You know, all of I've always had business coaches since I've been in business, and across the board, they have all said, Denise, you need to meditate. I can't meditate. My mind doesn't shut down. What happens is I either fall asleep, fall sideways and drool, or I'm like, or I'm like, ooh, squirrel, ooh. Thanksgiving list, and I'll start making my Thanksgiving list in July. my brain works. So what I did find, and maybe this works for some people, but somebody suggested a walking meditation to me. I went, So every morning I get on my treadmill, and I do what I term a walking meditation, where I'm literally talking, kind of to my spirit guides or angels or whatever you want to call them. And I'm talking, and I'm setting forth my kind of program for the day, and I'm asking for help. And then the last 15 minutes of my walking meditation, I'm just quiet. And I'm listening to the thoughts that are coming into my head from wherever they're coming, my subconscious, guides, whatever your spirituality demands. I mean, that's where it's coming. And it works brilliantly for me. Sitting meditation, I drool. I can't do it.
Yeah, I mean, there are different versions for different people. I think people find different types that they're more drawn to. I think the thing that I would say to people who, you know, sit down to meditate and say they can't do it is that meditation is called a practice for a reason.
Right.
And so, you know, just like I'm a pianist and I had to practice to get good at it. I wasn't good the first day. It took a while to get a lot better. And I think people can be impatient with it and start to judge themselves, which you're not supposed to do with meditation, and decide, oh, I can't do this, or this is too hard, or, you know, and so they don't give themselves the chance to really settle or to learn to get good at it. So, yeah, I mean, like anything, it's a practice and sort of an acquired skill.
Well, and it took me the longest kind of time to find something that worked for me, but I was hearing it so much, so often from people that I really respect. I was like, I better look into this. You know, it doesn't work for me, but let's see if I can find something. And by golly, I found something, and I love it. And the reason I bring up spirituality is, well, a couple of reasons. I've been reading your book, and you talk a lot about spirituality in the book. And I think it's something important. I think it's very, very important that you kind of touch on that. We often hear that business and religion shouldn't mix, and I'm not necessarily talking about religion. I'm just talking about spirituality here, but you know, people have different ideas about what they are.
Uh-huh.
How do you reconcile the two? How do you talk about spirituality and business all in the kind of same sentence?
Yeah, and so when I think of spirituality, I think I also differentiate it from religion. And for me, spirituality is just sort of having a sense of something bigger than yourself, or a sense of purpose or meaning that you bring to your work. And it's interesting because in writing the chapter in the book, I thought a lot about whether or not I was even going to include it, just because I think that we hear so often that, you know, spirituality or religion and work shouldn't mix. And you would think
my
that.
My serious question, how can they not mix? It is who you are. Everything you do is who you are. You have to bring everything to the table. You can't pick and choose what you're going to put out there.
I totally agree.
Although people do, I don't. But, you know, I think people do.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And it's interesting because, you know, I think a lot of people who I work with are very spiritual, but when I'm meeting with them, they don't necessarily want to talk about it, or they'll kind of test me and they'll, like, put out a little nugget of something that suggests that they're spiritual to see what I'll do with it. And for me, because I know that that's such an integral part of who anybody is, I'll explore it. And then it's like you can see them just sort of relaxing, realizing that they can talk about this part of themselves that's really important to them. But, you know, I think spirituality impacts our values. It impacts how we view the world, and it gives us a sense of direction. And so if we're not thinking about that in the work world, in a sense, we're sort of ignoring a really important piece of motivation for us. And there's actually some interesting research in which someone named, her last name is Rusnevsky. I always mispronounce it. But she looked at different approaches that people took to their work. And people who saw their work as a calling or something that was sort of something that they needed to do because they had a passion for it, those people, you know, were more productive at work. They, you know, put more effort in. They were more likely to kind of achieve a flow state at work, or that sense that, you know, you're fully in the zone and immersed in the work and time doesn't matter. And, you know, as you might expect, they actually produced better work because they were so tied up into what they were doing. And so I think if you're not exploring that in your work and how you can make your work more meaningful to you, you know, you're likely to be in the sort of career where you might be miserable for 40 years and then at the end wonder what it was all for.
Oh, gosh. I know. Yeah. You know, really, you're describing the entrepreneurial mindset. I have yet to speak to an entrepreneur of any description that didn't know exactly what they were doing, why they were doing it, what impels them, what drives them, and why they're so passionate about it. It's been described to me many, many times, and I've described it to myself as the same. It's just a knowing. We just know that this is what we're supposed to be doing. For instance, I just knew that I was going to make a very good living with a computer back in the day when there was no internet. I mean, I bought a I kid you not, and it wasn't that long ago, by the way. And I bought a $3,000 computer. It was MS-DOS. I learned MS-DOS. I spoke it in my sleep. It was a very fancy filing cabinet. It was a boat anchor. But I waited it out, and I knew that there was going to be a way for me to create a living using a computer. And when the internet came along, I went, oh, it's mine. God made it for me. It's all mine. And I shared it with everybody else, but it's mine. But I always had this deep knowing that I would be able to create the lifestyle that I wanted under my own terms with a computer. And nobody could ever talk me out of it. Not that I spoke about it. I just knew. And I proceeded and just waited it out. And I think many, many entrepreneurs have that sense of knowing and that sense of wonderment and that sense of gratitude when it all comes together. But we never stop. We just keep on going.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as an entrepreneur, you need that sense of knowing and that sense of purpose because I think the work can be very hard. And, you know, it can take a while for profits to come in. And so having a sort of the North Star can help you to deal with a lot of the stresses that go along with it. And I think
like that.
The
North Star.
Well, and I think the other thing that's really important.
You summed it up.
And I think the other thing that's so important for entrepreneurs is, you know, sometimes in the day-to-day grind, when it feels overwhelming and you have so much stuff going on, making sure that you take the time to take a step back and remind yourself why you're doing it, or, you know, what am I learning through this experience, or how is this meaningful to me, so that you don't just get caught up in the task, but you, again, remind yourself what it's all about.
And you're right, it is hard. I mean, if anybody thinks what we do as entrepreneurs is easy, oh boy, there's a school somewhere for that. I'm sure there is. It's not easy, and we often, you know, work 18-hour days. We're not kidding. We don't sleep a whole lot. You know, but that's kind of by design. We really don't want to sleep. We're so excited about everything. You know, it's,
yeah, and I think unless you have that sense of passion, you really don't have any business being an entrepreneur.
Yeah,
like, I think a lot of people romanticize being their own boss, but don't realize the amount of work and also the amount of uncertainty that goes along with it. And so you really do need that sense of passion and purpose. Otherwise, I think, you know, you'll just fizzle out and be disappointed.
Yeah, it can be scary. I mean, it can be very frightening to just kind of branch out on your own and just say, well, I'm going to make this work. Oh, gosh. And look, I've been doing this for a while, and I still have those days like, what in the heck were you thinking? You know, but it doesn't last long. I get over it. Okay, now in your book, you mentioned that happiness is important for leaders, and that, again, I think is something that the general populace at large just doesn't understand. So what are some of the things that individuals, leaders, you know, owner operators, whoever they are, what are some things that they can do to increase their happiness level and make it stay? I mean, not just get a bump and then go back to being depressed. I mean, what can they do to really work on themselves?
Yeah, so just like meditation is a practice, I think happiness is a practice as well, like making sure that you're being intentional about doing things that bring happiness. And there's been a lot of research actually done in this, probably in the past 15 years or so, where they've looked at sort of scientifically derived things that you can do to increase your happiness. And, you know, one thing, for example, that you mentioned is gratitude. And, you know, something really simple you hear about, you know, people doing gratitude journals. And that's actually backed up by science, that if you take time at the end of the day and write down, you know, three things for which you're grateful, you actually tend to increase your happiness. And one study even found that gratitude was more effective than medication for dealing with certain types of depression, because it encourages you to look at the world differently. Basically, you're looking back and seeing things for which you're grateful, but also knowing that you're going to be doing the exercise makes you more aware of things during the day for which you're grateful, because you know you're going to be, you know, writing it down later on. So that's a really simple thing you can do to increase your happiness. Another thing that's been found is acts of kindness. And again, these things seem very intuitive, but there's also the research that backs them up, which is so interesting. And, you know, specifically with acts of kindness, what they found is that you should try to do a bunch of them in a day, kind of give a super kindness day, and that boosts your mood.
It actually does.
Yeah, no, I know whenever I've done nice things for people, like the other person liked it, but it always made me have this like little glow inside too. And, you know, it could be anything from giving a compliment to someone to, you know, maybe tipping your waitress a little bit extra, or, you know, helping a colleague on a project. But all of those sorts of things have an impact on you. So that's something else that you can focus on. One last one that I mentioned before is meditation. And meditation really is a cure-all for a lot of different things. But in terms of happiness, if you're a regular meditator, it actually affects your brain physiology in such a way that the parts of your brain that are associated with happiness kind of increase in size, like you get more gray matter there, and the parts of your brain that are associated with stress and fear actually decrease in terms of brain matter. There was actually a really interesting study about that. And so that's yet another reason to try a meditation practice. It'll make you happier. Yeah.
Well, and you mentioned a holistic approach too. And you're right. I've noticed since I've been doing what I call the walking meditation, I'm calmer. You know, for me, I get out of bed, I hit the floor, I brush my teeth. I'm going all day long. And I may not go to bed until 11 o'clock midnight, and I'm going all day long. And I've had to train myself, and that's a word that you're using that I think is so important, train myself to take those timeouts, go outside, you know, play with the dog, you know, shred my little checkoff list, you know, seize those moments and really just kind of get into them. They don't have to last long, but they do have to be there. You have to intersperse them throughout the day. And what I'm finding, and I wanted to ask you about this, because you talk about a holistic approach, I think meditation is a big part of what a lot of people could do, but I also think that proper nutrition, I'm not using the word diet, I'm using the word proper nutrition. Lots of water and movement are also very, very important for a holistic approach to happiness.
Yeah, it really is. I'm glad you brought that up. I mean, there's a lot of research that talks about the impact of exercise on your mood. And, yeah, I mean, your body functions more effectively when you're exercising. You're actually boosting your level of concentration and becoming better at problem solving. And there's also research about nutrition, just like you're saying. I actually wrote a blog post about various research articles that talk about how eating a balanced diet with more fruits and vegetables is associated with better overall well-being and mood. And again, I think it's just a matter of disciplining ourselves to do these things. Mm-hmm. They sound really easy and, again, intuitive, but, you know, we can get so busy that we just go for whatever easiest.
Right.
And it's really just prioritizing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, you know, my husband and I eat out all the time, but it's a matter of really prioritizing these things in your life because they have a positive impact, you know, in all aspects of your life. Mm-hmm. So, yeah.
So basically it's just take a break. This is what I've been trying to do, and it's kind of sort of working. I'm training myself again. I'm always in training for something. But I'm really training myself to stop when I'm about to make a decision that I know I'm going to regret. Because I'll leave my desk, run for the refrigerator, open it up and go, oh, grab something. I haven't even thought about it. It's almost a muscle memory. So I'm now saying stop, walk over there, breathe, determine what your choice is going to be, and I have a chat with myself. And, you know, I will grab an orange or a bag of peanuts, you know, a small bag of peanuts or something instead of chips, if they're even in the house. You know, if you take that deep breath and go, okay, you have choices. Which one are you going to choose? It slows your brain down enough, and it slows your body down enough to where you can go, oh, well, let me answer that. You oftentimes make the right choice, you know, or a better choice at any rate. So I think everything we do with the holistic approach is really a matter of choices, isn't it, to make the choice to make the proper decisions or the better decisions.
Yeah, it's, you know, you hear the term mindfulness being thrown around a lot, and it's really sort of the foundation of living a mindful life is the sort of life where you are being present, I guess, and not being reactive, but being purposeful about what you're doing by paying attention sort of non-judgmentally to what's going on with you. So instead of, like you said, just being reactive and not really thinking and, you know, not being fully present in what you're doing, you're really approaching life in a different way that is more purposeful and, you know, is hopefully going to result in better choices for you, ones that are more nourishing.
Right, right. So, and that leads us to self-awareness. And you say in your book that self-awareness should be a foundation for all leaders. Well, that should be a no-brainer, I would think. But people aren't aware. We are reactive and things. How can people, what can leaders do in the corporations or whether they're like me and they lead a team of, you know, VAs and web developers, what can we do to become more self-aware and, I guess, by extension, more aware of what we need to bring to our team?
So, yeah, to start, I mean, I do think self-awareness is really important, and it's the foundation for a lot of how we go about our work. And so knowing what your strengths are, the areas where you need to grow, knowing what your stress triggers are, or, you know, when you're likely to not be at your best, all of that is important. And I think, you know, on an intellectual level, most people think that's important. But I also think that as we go about our day-to-day work, it's the sort of thing that, again, we just don't take a step back to really self-reflect and learn more about ourselves. And so I think and what I found is a lot of people who believe in self-awareness aren't necessarily as self-aware as they tend to think that they are. And
really?
I think that it's because, yeah, and I think it's because they just don't take the time to really think about things. And so, you know, one thing in terms of being more self-aware that you can do is take a moment to step back and just self-reflect. You know, if you're doing something, think about why am I doing this? Or if, you know, you're in a situation where you get really frazzled or upset about something, try to be objective and think, what is about this is making me so upset? What button was just pushed in myself? You know, how can I approach the situation in a way that's going to be effective that I'm not going to regret? And so it is that kind of stopping and taking a breath and paying attention. Another way that you can increase self-awareness really effectively is by asking for feedback. You know, asking people, what do I do really
well?
Now,
that's scary. That's got to be really frightening to people. I just cringe myself, like, nope, not doing that one.
That one is so educational, though, because if you have a blind spot, the only way you're ever going to figure it out is by having somebody tell you, right?
No.
Because you're blind to it.
I can hear people right now going, Denise, I'd like to have a chat. Oh, my God, no.
Yeah, but, you know, asking people on the positive, what do I do really well? Are there some things that I could do more of that would make me more effective? Also asking, where could I grow? You know, are there ways that I might be tracked from the team or, you know, that I'm not aware of? So really asking others for feedback and making it easy for them to give you feedback can help you to get a deeper sense of self-awareness. And, you know, I think for those of us who have significant others, paying attention to the feedback that they give us. because like I said, we're whole people, and so a lot of the things that play out at home do play out at work, even though we might want to dismiss them. So, you know, really paying attention to that I think is important too. And then also just taking the time to self-reflect. And, you know, in my book, I provide a lot of questions for self-reflection that encourage you to think about everything from how your family background and your experiences in childhood might influence how you view the world or your beliefs about things, you know, encouraging you to reflect on your values and a lot of really deep questions that, again, the average person just doesn't really think about that much. But I think when you have those deeper insights into how you work as a person, it really helps you to kind of see yourself in a different way and be more intentional about how you're interacting with people and the world.
And I love that you're using the word intentional. I think it's such an important part of this conversation. You know, it's so easy to just blurt out what you're thinking or, like, say, run to the refrigerator or jump in the car, run through a McDonald's. It's just so easy to do all of these things without thinking. And then at the end of the day, I don't know about you, when I do silly things like that, I can spend some real quality time just going, bad Denise, bad Denise. Just, I'm really genuinely trying to be more mindful about my day-to-day, minute-to-minute, hour-to-hour decisions. Do I really want to do this? Is this going to move me forward? Is this going to make me any money today? You know, is this going to make me go bad, Denise, at the end of the day? So, you know, I'm really trying to be more mindful. And I have to tell you, I'm liking myself a whole lot better. You know, I never hated myself, but now I'm going, ooh, good girl. So it's not a difficult thing to do to, you know, look at yourself, make these decisions, make them for yourselves and the way you're going to treat the people around you, and then have a good day as a result of those mindful intentions. I mean, and I think that's what you're saying here today is just be mindful, be impactful, and be thoughtful.
Yeah, I think when you do things that nurture yourself or encourage your growth, you always feel better than if you're doing things that, you know, are kind of a short-term gain, but in the long term, you know, aren't in your best interest. You know, I think we're all here to self-actualize and to be our best selves. And the way you do that is through the choices that you make minute by minute.
That is so true, and it took me the longest darn time to figure that out. And when I did, I just stood there and I kind of looked at my internal self and went, really? I just felt so dumb. You know? And to this day, I just go back and go, how could you not know? But life is a journey. Listen, why did you write your book? I know stepping from your corporate responsibilities out into entrepreneurship, that's a big step. And your book is a big, big part of that. So why did you write the book?
You know, one of the reasons why I wrote it, I think, was, you know, like I mentioned, I do a lot of personality testing in my work. And the way things were set up is that I would, you know, do the testing and then sit down with the person and give them some feedback about it. But I might not necessarily have the opportunity to be able to coach them across time. And so they would ask me, can you give me some suggestions of books that I could read? And I could think of books that were good for certain things, like, you know, if you want to be a better delegator, read this, or if you want to be more organized, read that. But the sort of deep dive that I think can be so beneficial for people to become more effective. I just couldn't find a book like that. And so eventually I just thought, okay, well, I know what I would want the book that I would recommend people to say. So why don't I just sit down and attempt to write it? And, you know, I don't know if you've written books before, but it can be something that is easier said than done.
I'm like in the middle of one. Yeah. And I have written, honestly, Patricia, I have written the epic first blank page. It's gorgeous. Not a thing on it. I have a working title. You know. That's it.
Well, in the past, I'd started a lot of books that I'd never finished, and I'd actually never gotten past the first chapter. So I don't necessarily know what made this time different, except that I think that I had a really good reason for wanting to do it, which was to help people. And so that was why I wrote it. And the other reason why I wrote it was I really enjoy coaching people, but I know that not everybody can, you know, afford to have an executive coach, or they might not have the time to do it. And so I really wanted to have an interactive workbook that could guide people through how to develop in the certain areas that I think are most important for just effectiveness as a leader, but effectiveness overall at work. But I also wanted to make sure that, you know, some of the concepts that I talk about, some of the more skeptical people can think that they're pretty, I guess, like airy-fairy, I guess. And so I wanted to make sure that there was a lot of research in there so that people would understand why I was making the suggestion. So really the book was written to educate, but also to give a really practical template to be able to grow and develop in important ways.
And I noticed that when I was reading it, I read a lot of business books. I interview a lot of authors, a lot of speakers, and I've got an entire two shelves in my office that are dedicated to books that have been sent to me that are autographed, and I love these books. I won't read them. If they're autographed, they go on the shelf, and then I order the book on Kindle, and I read that one. I'm not going to break that. That's just my thing. But here's the thing. I've been reading yours, and I notice that it's backed up by a lot of research. I mean, this is not just you kind of tossing out, meditate, go do this. I mean, you are making some very, very good common sense suggestions and, you know, paths to go down, but you're backing it with solid research. And that's not something you often see in a business book, I have to tell you.
Yeah, I think that was one thing that I really wanted to make sure I did, just because I think a lot of business books are written based sort of theory, and it sounds like it makes sense. But, you know, as someone who has spent a lot of time in school, there's that critical thinker part of me that wants to know that it makes sense. And while I think that you can't measure everything in the world, I really wanted to write it for the sort of business person who maybe comes with that bent. And so being able to convince them that, you know, focusing on kindness is important and giving them the business case for doing it in some sense was really the approach that I wanted to take. Yeah. So I'm glad that you read it that way. That's great.
Well, I did. And I'm like you. I'm a logical, linear, analytical thinker with a goofball sense of humor. But, you know, I noticed things like that, and I went, okay. And I was fascinated by the depth of the research that you did.
Oh, thank you. So I appreciate
it's
that.
It's a good book. I mean, for our audience, in fact, tell people, if you don't mind, where they can go get that book, because I think people do need to read this book.
Yeah, so the book is called The Consummate Leader, and you can get it on Amazon. It's and actually Barnes & Noble. Both as a paperback, or if you're an e-reader like you are, then you can get it there. It's also available on iTunes, and it's becoming more available in different places. I've seen, if you have any readers in Canada, it's now available in Chapters in Canada. So it's available in a lot of different places at this point.
Are you going to put it on Audible?
At some point, I have the desire to, because I listen to a lot of audiobooks.
Me too.
I just have to get around to doing that. But, that'll be my next step.
Yeah, people learn differently. I buy a lot of books on Audible, business books, because I can listen, I can compartmentalize. And I'll be building a website or two, and I'm actually listening to, you know, Stephen Covey or Brendan Bouchard. And I love listening to books while I'm reading, because while I'm working, because I pick up enough to make me go, ooh, and I'll stop listen, and then I'll go back to work. But it's almost like I'm learning subliminally. It's an amazing thing. So let me know when it's out. I will grab it on Audible.
Okay,
I would love to hear it. Are you going to record it yourself? You should. You've got a great voice.
I've been thinking of doing that. I've heard it can take a while and you need to make sure you have water, but that's my plan.
Yeah. Listen, we have in the chat room, we have a question. Do you have a moment to take a question?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, the question is from James Artry. He was actually on my show last week. Dr. Thompson, what methods have you used to successfully change the mindset of CEOs, many of whom are anal retentive, numbers-minded personalities, into understanding that it is your employees that achieve the numbers and not the numbers themselves?
Mm-hmm. Well, again, I think the research really helps in that respect. Because I've worked with a lot of different organizations, I'm able to give them concrete examples of different teams that I've worked with and done team building with and help the employees to work more effectively together to achieve more positive outcomes. Really, it has a lot just to do with giving them examples of it having worked in the past. Just telling them that it's a good idea doesn't tend to work with that sort of a person. And what I'll also say is, you know, even with all of that evidence, there are some people who just are not inclined to want to listen to it. And in that case, you know, it's kind of like you can lead the horse to water, but mm-hmm. you can't make them drink all the time. And I just feel like they're missing out on an important competitive advantage. But, you know, I think eventually if they keep looking at how the research is going, they'll just realize that they might be late to the party in the future.
Good point. Is some of this corporate kind of persona, is it almost like being in a goldfish bowl? I mean, they feel like they have to behave like this? Or do people really just kind of lose track of who they really are?
I think it varies. I mean, I think a lot of different types of people end up ascending to CEO. And so what I don't want to do is stereotype because, like I said, I've worked with a lot of CEOs who have, you know, hearts of gold, who really care about people and the environment in which they're working in and really focus on the culture. And what I'll say is those sorts of organizations tend to have highly engaged workforces who are loyal to the organization, and they end up having really positive outcomes. So there's a whole set of CEOs that are like that who really understand the importance of culture. For others, they might want to be a CEO for different reasons. It could be mm-hmm. that they're ambitious and they like the idea of having power and being at the helm. And, you know, for them that are into it for that sort of reason, they're probably less inclined to want to think about culture and more just inclined to think about how they can drive the most money through, you know, means that might not mm-hmm. think as much about people. But there's a range of personalities. So.
Excellent. Well, James says, thank you. I think it comes back to the spiritual element you spoke about earlier. That is resonating with our audience.
Well, that's great. I'm glad I included that chapter.
Me too. Listen, you said that when we were talking last week or whenever it was, I think it was about a week ago, you mentioned that the genesis of this book was a breakup in your personal life. Do you mind sharing about that? Because that's a big step to go from something that was, you know, personally a little bit catastrophic to going, I'm going to write a book.
Yeah, well, so about 5 years ago, someone who I thought I was going to marry, we actually ended up breaking up. And that was probably one of the biggest, I don't want to say call it a trauma and be like melodramatic about it, but for me it was a big deal.
Oh, come on, go for it.
Okay, it was devastating.
There you go.
And for me it was a really big deal. And I found that even though I was a clinical psychologist, and so I knew a lot of things that you're supposed to do to cope with a breakup, a lot of that stuff wasn't working for me. So, you know, I would exercise and I would write in my journal and I would, you know, read self-help books, and that helped to some extent, but not as much as I would have hoped. And so that was when I personally went into a lot of deep self-reflection and tried to learn more about myself and experiment with different approaches to life, like got more into reading about spirituality and, you know, attempting different alternative sorts of things, and just really learned a lot more about myself as a person and had this deeper sense of self-awareness and purpose in life. because I decided that even though I'd broken up, I didn't want to be bitter. I really wanted to learn from the experience. And so as a result of all of that self-reflection, I noticed that I got better at my work. You know, I was able to connect with people in a way that I wasn't able to connect before, and I was more aware of the impact that I was having on people. Mm. And so I was really able to see how working on this aspect of myself as a person had such an impact on my professional life. And, you know, I reflected on the people who I've coached and known that the people who have gone deeper into things in terms of self-reflection also tended to be better in terms of the impact they were having on people. And so that was another reason why I decided to write the book, because I saw the impact it had on my own life, kind of really doing this deep dive, and knew that others would have a similar sort of result. And so, you know, it was a bad thing that happened, but it, you know, always has a silver lining. And, you know, as luck would have it, about 6 months later, I met my now husband. So there's a happy ending to the story, too.
And you have a baby.
I do, yeah.
It all worked out beautifully. Yeah,
it did.
And the thing is, you were able to take, instead of becoming bitter and, you know, sarcastic and kind of mean about life, you know, you were able to go, let me go within and see what's going on here. And I love that story. Been there, done it, and will continue to do it because, you know, these things happen all the time. I mean, you're not going to just have one catastrophe in your life, major, minor, you know, catastrophic. They're going to happen. Life is
right.
Really all about running around putting out fires. It's how you deal with them, isn't it?
Yeah, it's you know, you hear about post-traumatic stress all the time, mm-hmm. but there's actually a psychological phenomenon that's known as post-traumatic growth. And, you know, there
really?
Are some people who go through, yeah, and you, there's a segment of the population that go through really negative events, but they become better for it. Like, I'm sure you've heard stories of, you know, someone getting cancer and then them saying, mm-hmm. wow, but that was the best thing that happened to me
yeah.
because I grew in all these ways as a person. And so I think if you can have the right attitude about things, regardless of what happens to you, you can learn and become a better person for it.
I love that story, and thank you so much. I know it's a tough story to tell, but thank you so much for sharing it.
Oh, you're welcome. Yeah.
Listen, what are some of the tools, Patricia? We've only got about 2.5 minutes. Can
okay.
you share? I think you have shared some tools. Journaling, I think, is one that you shared. Positive affirmations, meditation. Are there any other tools that maybe we haven't discussed that people can look into to, you know, just kind of gain clarity about who they are and why they're doing the things that they're doing?
Yeah, you know, I think really the main one is just trying to be more aware of it. And so what we talked about taking a step back and really just paying attention to things, trying to be as objective and as non-judgmental as possible as you're going through your life, kind of being compassionate with yourself. You know, we've talked a lot about going home and saying, oh, bad Denise, that kind of thing. But I think talking to yourself as you would like a child or, you know, someone that you really cared about, and that self-compassion, I think, can really take you a long way. So,
well, you know, those internal dialogues can get really ugly if you let them.
Mm-hmm. They can.
Yeah. So I catch myself. You know, I've learned to catch myself when I'm telling myself, oh, I've got a headache. Or, you know, when you start the whining down here in
yeah.
the deep south, we call it boudet. You don't want a boudet around me because I'll smack you a good one. When I start to boudet, I will just go, really, Denise? And I have a talk with myself. And then I end up
uh-huh.
laughing. So, but you have to catch it. You have to be aware
yeah.
enough to catch it.
Yeah, in the book I actually have a chapter called Self-Management that's all about sort of managing your thoughts and the things that you're saying mm-hmm. to yourself. So, yeah.
Excellent. Well, listen, where can people find you on the web? And one more time about the book.
Yeah, so the book is called The Consummate Leader, A Holistic Guide to Inspiring Growth in Others and in Yourself. But if you just look up Consummate Leader, you'll find it. And my website is www.patricia-thompson.com. And you can look me up there.
Excellent. Do you have any parting thoughts for the audience?
Not really. I guess what I would say is if there's something that I didn't cover that you're curious about, feel free to go to my website and just send me a question through Contact Me, because I'm always really interested to you know, hear what readers have to say or, you know, questions that they might have, because that gives me ideas about future blog postings or, you know, if I decide I'm going to write another book, you know, maybe how I might approach that. So really interested in those sorts of things. So I do encourage you to reach out.
Great. Patricia, yeah. Thank you so much for being with me here today. You are a joy to speak with, and I always have such a great time, and I always learn from you, which I think is a wonderful thing. And I know our audience has learned a great deal from you today as well. So thank you so much.
Oh, well, thank you. This has really been a pleasure. So I hope everyone benefited, and thank you.
Oh, I know they did. Well, listen, the show will be available for download in about an hour. And you can also find us in iTunes. Just type in our names, Denise Griffiths and Dr. Patricia Thompson. And I will see you next week. Thank you, everybody.
You can find Denise Griffiths at yourofficeontheweb.com or at gottagovirtualnow.com. Thank you for joining us on Your Partner in Success Radio.